is Sarah Archie, and Sarah Miller Archie is an epidemiologist also with the World Trade Center Health Registry, and her work focuses on surveillance of chronic diseases such as heart disease, diabetes, asthma, and autoimmune diseases among persons who were exposed after 9/11. And so please come on up and inform us.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Today I'll be discussing the surveillance of autoimmune diseases within the World Trade Center Health Registry. And just to keep in mind, this is an ongoing study, so these results are preliminary. So Dr. Gargano was nice enough to give you an overview of the World Trade Center disaster and the World Trade Center Health Registry. But just to give you a quick recap, the registry is a prospective closed cohort study of 71,000 people who were exposed to 9/11 in New York City. There have since been three registry-wide follow-up surveys. And in addition to these major surveys, the registries also matches to administrative databases such as the National Death Index, state cancer registries, hospitalization registries such as SPARKS in New York State. And we also conduct in-depth clinical studies, one of which is this autoimmune disease study. So one of the reasons why we wanted to look into autoimmune diseases is that the dust cloud that resulted from the collapse of the World Trade Center towers contained elevated levels of crystalline silica, which has been linked to autoimmune diseases such as scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus in other populations. We also did it because the Fire Department of New York City, or FDNY, was conducting their own research. They've actually published two studies now, and they found that prolonged 9/11-related work exposure is linked to systemic autoimmune diseases. They also found that increased levels of 9/11 exposure is linked to autoimmune disease, and they've also found higher than expected levels of lupus within their cohort. Dr. Gargano also mentioned PTSD is one of the most common mental health outcomes resulting from 9/11, and in a Vietnam veteran registry, PTSD has been linked to RA and other autoimmune diseases. And there's some biological plausibility for this. The chronic stress reactions that result from PTSD may be a risk factor for autoimmune disease, either through increased inflammatory activity or through dysregulation of the immune system. So we decided to undergo this study partly because of community concern. We were getting questions from our community members, so that led us to add questions to our Wave 3 survey in 2011. And a preliminary analysis of that data suggested that there could possibly be a higher prevalence of autoimmune disease. I just spoke to the epidemiologic and biological plausibility of a connection, and we also at the time knew that FDNY researchers were conducting their own study, and in fact, we actually consulted with them to get their expertise. And finally, we couldn't just rely on our data from the Wave 3 survey, because multiple studies have found that autoimmune diseases are typically overreported by people. So really what you have to do is get a diagnosis verified by a physician. So the objectives of our autoimmune disease study were to confirm and describe post-9/11 autoimmune disease in our registry population, focusing on RA, lupus, scleroderma, myositis, Sjogren's syndrome, mixed connective tissue disease, and other autoimmune diseases that might be reported. And we wanted to assess the relationship between 9/11-related PTSD, 9/11-related exposure, and incident autoimmune disease. So to be considered for this study, a participant had to have completed their Wave 3 survey and answer yes to either having been diagnosed with RA or another autoimmune disease and report a year of diagnosis in 2001 or later. So of the 43,000 enrollees who completed Wave 3, 2,786 met this criteria, or about 6.5%. So this is kind of a three-phase study. So of the 2,786 enrollees who met our criteria, that led us to our phase one. So we sent all of them an in-depth survey about their autoimmune disease, and we had a 73% response rate to that, which led to phase two. We contacted all of the 2,042 participants and ask them to complete a consent form that would allow us to contact their physicians to learn more about their diagnosis. And of those, we had just over half send us back a completed form. That led to phase three, which is our physician-completed survey or a medical record review. And so far, we've gotten a record or a survey for 732 enrollees, and we've been able to analyze the data for 610. So first, I just want to speak briefly to the phase one in-depth enrollee survey. The survey included questions on general health status, on a family history of autoimmune disease, on medication use, and on their actual diagnoses. We also included something called the Connective Tissue Disease Screening Questionnaire, or the CSQ. And this is a self-report validated questionnaire that screens for RA, lupus, scleroderma, Sjogren's, myositis, and mixed connective tissue disease. And it does this by asking both about symptoms and diagnostic tests. And our study variables of interest are PTSD, which we measured at registry enrollment, and we use a cutoff score of 44 or higher on the PCL to define it. We also wanted to know whether someone was exposed to the dust cloud on 9/11, and we also wanted to know whether someone was a rescue or recovery or cleanup worker, so someone who was involved in that effort either at Ground Zero or on the Staten Island Fresh Kills landfill from September 11, 2001 through June 30, 2002. So some preliminary results from our phase one enrollee survey. We found that exposure to the 9/11 disaster was associated with incident RA, specifically PTSD, dust cloud exposure, and being a rescue recovery worker. We also found that only 39% of study participants who reported RA on their Wave 3 survey actually screened positive for it on the CSQ, which was important to us to let us know that we really needed to go contact their doctors to verify their diagnosis. The rest of this talk will be about phases 2 and 3 of this study. So just to go through this again, of the 2,042 enrollees who completed their survey, we then received a consent form from 1,042. We then went ahead and sent their physician a brief survey to ask about their diagnoses. And then to kind of boost our participation rates, we actually went ahead and called and faxed these offices to try to get them to fill out a survey. And while we did get hundreds of surveys sent back to us, a lot of doctors were unable for various reasons to complete a survey for us, but they were willing to send us the medical records of their patients. So we were happy to accept them and conduct the review on our end. This is also very time intensive, so we contracted with a vendor to help us with our medical record retrieval process. And with all of these pathways, we've now collected 732. So our physician survey content included criteria from the American College of Rheumatology on these six conditions. We also provided space for a doctor to let us know about other autoimmune diseases that we didn't specifically ask for. We also asked for the year of diagnosis, for medications they prescribed for the autoimmune disease, and whether or not they were a certified rheumatologist. And this is a survey. We tried to make it pretty clear and brief. It's just 2 pages. And for our analysis, we've used 2 case definitions. One that's more broad, we asked, we needed the physician to verify the diagnosis and say that it was diagnosed after 2001. Our second definition was more conservative, and not only did they have to meet definition one, but they also had to meet the American College of Rheumatology criteria. And we analyzed all of the main autoimmune diseases separately, but we also created a combined outcome for the definitions listed here, the outcomes listed here. Provided that they met definition one. And our control population were adults who completed the Wave 3 survey who answered no both to having ever been diagnosed with RA and no to having been diagnosed with any other autoimmune disease. So these were our preliminary results. So we identified 149 enrollees with at least one autoimmune disease, and about 5% of those actually had more than one. So we found 59 cases of RA, 20 of lupus, 12 of myositis, 9 mixed connective tissue disease, 6 scleroderma, 7 Sjogren's syndrome, and 49 enrollees who had an other autoimmune disease. And you'll see that in the second column with the ACR criteria, that number goes down. And one result that surprised me was that there were no enrollees who met the ACR criteria for Sjogren's syndrome. However, when I talked to our rheumatologist, he was not surprised. The ACR criteria that we use include a biopsy as a necessary criterion, and I guess in practice that's really not done. I also took a look at cases of RA and compared our findings from the physician verification to our Wave 3 survey. And of those who said they were diagnosed with RA on their Wave 3 survey, only 12% were verified by a physician, and only 9% met the ACR criteria. So I think it really drives home the need to conduct the verification. So here's a listing of the other autoimmune diseases. The most commonly reported were psoriatic arthritis, ulcerative colitis, psoriasis, sarcoidosis, and ankylosing spondylitis. Here are the diagnoses by year. You'll see that in 2007 there's an increase in the diagnoses, although I don't know if there's really a strong pattern necessarily. One thing you might note is that we're still getting diagnoses of cases after our Wave 3 survey. In some instances, that's because people were diagnosed with more than one autoimmune disease. They may have been in the process of being diagnosed when they completed their Wave 3 survey. And here are results characterized by both demographics and 9/11-related characteristics. So you'll see here the majority of our cases were in females, which isn't surprising, and also in older enrollees. And 20 to 35% occurred in non-white enrollees. About half occurred in ever smokers. And the results that really jumped out at me were for post-traumatic stress disorder. So you'll see that 36% of our PTSD cases had 36% of our RA cases had PTSD, and 60% of our lupus cases had PTSD. Now, of our controls, only 13% had PTSD. You'll also see that for intense dust cloud exposure, that ranged from 25% to 41%, and the proportion of rescue recovery workers ranged from 39% for the other autoimmune diagnoses to 58% for rescue recovery workers. And here are the results from our bivariate analysis, which also include the controls. And you'll find for every outcome, females were significantly more likely to have an autoimmune disease outcome. And PTSD was associated with RA, with lupus, and with our combined outcome. And you'll also see that dust cloud and being a rescue recovery worker was not significantly associated with any of the outcomes, which is different from our phase one results. So just to summarize, we identified 149 enrollees who had a physician-verified post-9/11 autoimmune disease diagnosis. Female gender and PTSD were associated with incident RA, lupus, and a combined outcome, and neither intense death cloud exposure nor having been a rescue recovery worker were associated with incident autoimmune disease, which was different from our phase one results. And these findings are preliminary and may change as we continue to collect more cases. Some of the strengths of this study include its large sample size. We had a high response rate to the initial survey, and we have data from 9/11 exposures and health symptoms, and the fact that now we have physician-verified cases. Some limitations include the fact that we didn't ask about autoimmune disease until 2011. So, you know, keeping in mind loss of follow-up for our surveys, we might actually be underestimating the true frequency of disease. Also, the fact that less than 40% of our RA cases screen positive on the CSQ, and the fact that only 12% even were verified by a physician really highlights the need for physician verification for self-reported AD. And finally, we have a small number of cases, so there's always the potential for lack of statistical power. Some of the challenges that we're currently facing are the fact that autoimmune diseases are not covered as a World Trade Center health program condition for treatment. So if an enrollee contacts us, we actually can't refer them to care for that. And also obtaining medical records and conducting a review is very resource intensive. So we're going to continue to obtain and conduct review of our enrolling medical records, and we hope to present our findings to the World Trade Center Health Program. So I'd like to thank NIOSH, who funds the registry, as well as the core study project team, many other people at the registry and in other institutions who've helped us with this, and of course, our enrollees. Thank you very much.
Wow, these are really great speakers. If I could invite all four of you to come up and sit over here and share the one mic. We'll start with questions. While they're coming up there, I want to do a shameless plug because At 1 o'clock today, we're going to have a roundtable in the Rapids Room, which is around the corner, one way or the other, in the what's the name of the hotel?
Grove
Hotel. So it's the Rapids Room is on the third floor, and that's going to be the CSTE Disaster EPI Subcommittee. We'll be discussing the impacting disaster preparedness, response, and recovery by using epidemiology. So shameless plug, I want to invite you all to go grab lunch and come and join us as you're able for that. So now, with that, let's have the first questioner, and then please introduce yourself, your name, where you're from, and any relevance, if there is, to any one of those topics that they talked about.
My name is Jonathan Bressler. I work with the state of Alaska. I work in environmental health there and mainly deal with lead and things like this. But I'm a volunteer ski patroller, and you know, some of the first responder stuff is relevant. And I'm wondering, for Dr. Gargano, when we're looking at people who have, you know, first responders who have had PTSD or something like that in screening, for post sort of exposure to that, what sort of recommendations we have for, you know, do we remove people from, you know, let's say something, a situation like this, we have World Trade Center and then Sandy, is the recommendation to, like, remove first responders who have PTSD or things like this from that environment? Or I'm just wondering, you know, what sort of recommendations do we have for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we don't, since FDNY has their own cohort, we tend to have a smaller number of firefighters. For police, you know, I think we run into an issue of underreporting, you know, so we actually see once the police retire, all of a sudden their PCL score goes up. Because they're in fear of somehow their survey findings will end up back at, you know, whatever the precinct or whatnot, and they'll be, you know, they're gone and they'll be put on desk duty, which of course is, I guess, a cop's biggest fear. But I feel like for FDNY and NYPD, they provide the resources, you know, if somebody does kind of need somebody to talk to. I feel like it's maybe especially after 9/11, people were a little bit more understanding, and maybe any of the issues around, you know, a cop trying to seek help for something like that kind of went away because of how tragic it was for them. But that's, you know, we don't, yeah, that's all I can, you know, it's a sensitive, I think, topic for them.
Before the next question, I think your question is relevant, and so is the study for ERMS, which is the Emergency Responder Health Monitoring and Surveillance effort to track impacts that responders may have due to the work that they do. And understanding that, I think this study goes a long way to underscoring the importance of paying attention to that, not just to say who are we going to exclude, but to recognize that we need to support with mental health services and physical health services all of our responders, because we invest a lot in those assets.
Hi, my name is Lilia Lukowski. I am from Veterans Emergency Management Evaluation Center. We are based off Greater Los Angeles area. And I would like to ask you if you, in your cohort, if you ask them if they're veterans, because you know there's a lot of veterans who are first responders, if you ever ask them for their veteran status.
I mean, not specifically.
I don't think so.
Not that I can recall, like, you know, if they ever served active duty or anything like that. I don't think so. But yeah, I mean, yeah, but we would assume a large percent of them come in after serving.
Our center did a survey around Hurricane Sandy. I'm actually presenting a poster tomorrow related to the Hurricane Sandy survey that we did with veterans.
Oh, really?
Which
okay.
Is a little bit different topic, but also would be interesting to know how many of people in your cohort are.
Right. I mean, it would be interesting to know how, in general, not even, you know, 9/11, but how veterans who go in as police officers deal with things versus somebody who did not serve and became a police officer, and if there's different coping or stress triggers and that kind of stuff. But
exactly. Yeah. And another question that I have, You were talking about these two groups in the middle that had sort of a borderline score for PTSD. Can you tell us if there's a difference? Is these people different from these other ones? Like, you know, because they have this borderline score either way.
Yeah, so we, the registry and then FDNY has also kind of looked at these trajectory groups, and we did separate analyses, one that focused on our rescue recovery workers and another one that's focused on the survivors or non-rescue recovery workers. And, you know, some of the, for the rescue recovery worker analysis, some of the findings were what you would expect, you know, those who ended up getting, like, worse or in that very high, consistently high group tended to be, you know, lower income, there was a higher minority population, lower social support, and then for the survivors, it was something very similar when you kind of compared those who stayed low versus those who ended up getting high. It usually ended up being things like social support, social integration, as opposed to maybe economic risk factors that you might think.
And what about those who stayed high?
Those who stayed high, I'm trying to, I don't, beyond the, this, what you would think, I think unmet healthcare need might have been, I'm trying to picture her graph in my head, unmet mental health care need might have been one, as far as people who stay very high. I just remember, I think, for the survivors, that the big findings out of that were that really the role that, that social support and social integration and trying to keep people from isolating themselves. And I think that was the biggest thing on whether people got better or got worse or stayed bad.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Andy Smith, and let's see all my conflicts of interest here. So I'm the state toxicologist of the Maine Health Department, PI on the tracking grant and on the climate and health grant, and we also operate a number of syndromic surveillance syndromes. So this is for ECTA. Curious about your comment that you're going to evaluate electronic data feeds for emergency department data. I wonder if you would just talk to me about what you're thinking and the value of that if we already have very good data feeds with Essence and systems like that. So what is it you're thinking of doing with tracking that we're not already getting or can build on, you know, an infrastructure that already exists?
Thank you. So that's exactly right. So we are reviewing what already exists. We really don't want to rebuild that already is there. But we are also looking into the limitation. In essence, is one of the first one that we looked into. But the main issue that we had there is the focus is not towards disaster, and the data type that is being exchanged is not towards disaster. So we are, at this point, are doing a key informant interviews with our stakeholders, specifically within CDC, who are with the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Emergency Department. And also, we also have Dr. Renee Funk here. We did one key informant interview with her because she manages that emergency response of National Center for Environmental Health. Most of our data needs during a disaster at this time uses different methods, and Essence actually have not been one of the we have used in the past. So that is kind of interesting that that system exists, but we have not used it for, and from the environmental health perspective at least. Mm-hmm. So trying to understand why, and tracking, we wanted to explore mainly because we use it for tracking states, and we also use it for non-tracking state for data exchange. And our experience with the non-tracking state, especially with West Virginia, it was very easy for them to do data exchange. With Kentucky before they became a tracking state, it was very easy for them to do the data exchange using the current platform. So, which gave us kind of, you know, more sense that we'd probably be leaning towards it, but we are not done with our key informant interviews yet. So I hope to include those by end of July and then have a report, and then based on those information, that information we'll build that if we need to develop a brand new or if can we leverage the existing, and Essence is definitely one of them.
And a follow-up, please. So one thing you might want to look into is providing views of Essence data on the tracking portal. Mm-hmm. That's what we're starting to explore. So for instance, we do carbon monoxide poisoning during winter storm events. And so we are using it in a sort of sort of disaster sort of way. But that's not readily available to anyone other than people that have direct access.
Right.
And it actually looks like it may be fairly straightforward to provide views directly from that into our environment. So that may be a sort of low-hanging fruit way to sort of explain
definitely,
it.
Definitely, yeah. Thanks.
And to clarify, it's not necessarily just emergency department data or hospitalizations. It could also be results from, you know, needs assessments or surveys.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a normal structured data feed that would fit into some of these.
Okay.
Things. So
yeah.
What we're finding is there's still Excel spreadsheets, for example, or even pictures of surveys that are sent back and forth.
Right.
Collaboration, we're saying how is data information flowing during a disaster,
mm-hmm.
and what's the need?
Okay. Great. Thanks.
So in that way, as a quick follow-up, it sounds like states that have different capacities and are doing things differently can add that data in, at least for their own states?
Yes.
Okay.
Which we have done it in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's an important thing to know. Mm-hmm. Please stand up and tell us who you are.
Christine Henderson, Lansing, Michigan. Question, you may have said it and I missed it. The All Hazards Disaster Module, is it currently available and how do we access it?
Yes. It's, so you go to ephdtracking.cdc.gov, or if you Google CDC Tracking Network, you will get access to the tracking page, and from there, there's a link which says Explore Data. And once you go to Explore Data, it will bring up that screenshot, which is the portal. And then from there, it's very easy. It says step 1, 2, 3. You select your content area, your indicator, your measures, your geography, the years, and you can look into. We are working on the landing page, and landing page is on the tracking's website, not on the tracking portal, and then you can look at the information related to the content area that we have. So we will be adding more, but currently you can look into two content areas, the population vulnerabilities and the community infrastructure.
And we do have a climate change module as well.
Right.
We're adding in, which has heat, both temperature, extreme heat days, also heat hospitalization and UV. We also have precipitation. Those, both heat and precipitation are historical and future projected. We're adding in drought data. There's also flood zones. So there's additional under climate health,
due to
some additional relevant
areas. If you missed any of that, get a hold of Heather or get a hold of Ed at CDC, through their emails, because there's a lot of information there. And if you missed any of the, I'm sure they're there to provide assistance, because the whole goal is to get more people to access it and play with it and use it. So, John, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. John Sanderson with the Department of Homeland Security. I was curious when the question about veterans came up, because basically when 9/11 happened, we've been in a relatively long period of peace, or at least 8 years. So that may be an interesting factor pre-9/11, post-9/11, because basically since 9/11 we've been in a constant state of war with troops deployed since that time, and that may have an impact.
An impact on?
PTSD, and the sensitivity and the different populations as they move into first response.
So as you mean, as veterans demobilizing and leaving the service and taking jobs, yes,
yeah.
I think that's...
We certainly have a much larger population than we did pre-9/11.
Yes. Yes, please. Hi. I'm sorry. Hi.
No, you're fine.
Please stand up.
I'm Michelle Bird. I'm from MDHHS, so person just left, but just commissioned to Department of Health Care Services. I'm a chronic disease advocate, so I wanted to say, we're one of the people who got funded, so you can actually contact the person. So, but I'm curious because with the chronic disease, I was curious a couple things. I understand like you have to prioritize things, but I'm wondering how you're even gonna approach this chronic disease, like model or gathering the information, because it's important. It seems like there's prioritization in terms of severity, prioritization in terms of like immediate need of medication, like say someone needs an insulin shot or steroids or
Right. So, I mean, that's an interesting kind of thought that there is a lot of variation. Once you especially go even more nitty-gritty, the more finer level of data visualization, there is either data is not there, or, as you said, it's just too big, even at the census tract level, for kind of interpretation. So you kind of have to weigh in, you know, what you gain and what you lose and how much you can actually use. It is going to vary based on state to state or location to location. At this time, our main focus is to look more into historic data in terms of severity and of frequency for a larger picture, like by a state, and then within by a county or a particular region within a county. Okay. We have not added a lot of thought on chronic disease indicators specifically related to a disaster at this point. We do have some chronic disease indicator currently on the tracking network, which looks especially, one of them is asthma. And you can go at the county level, and I'm not sure that at census tract level yet, but we are looking into that, adding most of the content area available at the census tract level. And there are going to be challenges. Visualization, and then I think it's people who are at the local level can actually have a better understanding of that data and how they can use that. And we can always work with the locals in order to see how it can be improved for their use. And this is what I showed is all in the public portal, but there is additional functionality that can be available for that is not on the public portal. Right.
That's a really good idea. Because what we're most interested in is really that preparedness step. So being able to identify where you have communities that might have a high burden of chronic disease, and if there's a disruption of services, that you're going to have a problem that you need to plan for. But to your point about rural versus urban and sort of the sub county work, you know, tracking is involved in the scale project, and we are working on. In general, expanding all of our data to sub-county. And right now, the thought that we're all musing over, I guess, is that, you know, there's numbers are numbers. And if there are low numbers, there's nothing I can really do except add numbers to it so it's stable. And so one of the things we're actually piloting right now is to create two sub-county geographies, one that works well for rare outcomes, which would have a higher amount of census tract aggregation, and then one that would be for more common outcomes, which would have less census tract aggregation. But in this case, it can be responsive to the location of the population as well as the outcome that you're looking at. And as always, if either one of those still are producing stable estimates, then there's the temporal aggregation on top of it. And then there's also the use of different Bayesian methodology, or even just empirical Bayes, to help provide that stability. So,
going past the geographic, but looking at characteristics, common characteristics,
exactly.
And doing your aggregation that way. So you're like, okay,
yes.
These are areas that,
yeah.
Have common need.
Yeah, so that's another thing is when we do those census tract aggregations, being able to say, I want to aggregate like, and that's
yeah.
No, we haven't yet. Sometimes it can be hard for us to generalize to outside populations because we're majority white, better, higher education than normal, higher income. But we can try it. For FDNY, for example, I mean, they're majority white, majority male, but they found a reference population through the Rochester Epidemiology Project, and that's how they were able to calculate some of their incidence rates. So we might try to do that. And I know there's a project to look at lupus or creating lupus registries, a few different of them throughout the country. They just finished one in New York City. So we might be able to compare to that once it's published. Not yet, but I think once we kind of complete our data collection, we might try to do a match case control study, and then we'll be able to, you know, do multivariable models where we'll try to, you know, look for that. That's a really good idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Please. Hi, Marty Boardman, Climate Change, Washington State Department of Health, and I had two different questions, one for tracking mental health combined and one starting with landslide, and that is, in your literature review, did you discover I'm guessing not, but did you discover any data sources that could help us get a handle on landslides or, you know, more broadly? So that's question, I guess, number one.
Predictiveness of landslides or just understanding what to worry about?
Just initially, just basic landslides of a certain magnitude. You know, Public Works Department, I don't even know. You know, USGS, I'm sure, has a plethora of data that could tell you maybe some dimensions of risk, but how do, that seems even more complicated. So I was curious if you discovered anything like that, either in other countries or domestically. And then on the tracking mental health side, such a great pairing of panelists, of course, raises the question about how we start tracking mental health, especially, you know, in post-disaster situations as well as community health clinics. Thanks.
Thank you for your question. Actually, I don't have any data on that. I'll be happy to ask Nicole if she knows anything, but I don't believe that she did look into that quite yet. Thank you.
We have time for one more question before we go.
We just kind of both made notes just for that, looking into the available data sources for that. Yeah,
I know Section Group in Michigan have a data set where they surveyed a bunch of Katrina victims or survivors or whatnot, and they also have their own set of mental health. And I think the biggest thing is consistency between different groups, and I'm sure that's everybody's in any field's problem, you know, because we set up a collaboration with the Katrina to kind of compare their post-hurricane to our post-hurricane, and I mean, they don't have a full PCL, and then their responses for a PCL are not the standard. They have like a once a week, you know, and so I think, you know, that is always kind of the difficult thing, is getting everybody to agree.
And the only data sources that I can think of at the national level are the module that BRFSS have done in the past. But again, it's very limited data. It's not for all states, and it's not done every year. So there is a limited data available, and we can start. That's a start, but I think we need to look into more if there are rich data sources that are available. And usually for mental health, that's unfortunately, and there are not a whole lot out there.
Thank you. Last question.
Yeah, we have volunteers it's a hierarchical. So if you were a rescue recovery and a resident, you were a rescue. We categorize you as a rescue recovery worker. That does include volunteers, both professionals, so people associated with like the Red Cross, and then lay volunteers, so people who just kind of showed up to help. And we've published before looking at specifically at the volunteers and their health outcomes, and they don't do as well if they're lay versus organized versus you know, FDNY or police, most likely because of training. But we do ask about all that.
So please join me in thanking our speakers.